to the second case for this morning, which is Schmitz versus Canadian Pacific Railway Company.
Here from Mr. Richard Schmitz. This is an unusual case because the judge said at the instruction conference he was going to give the proposed instructions that Mr. Schmitz's trial counsel asked for on the federal vegetation control regulation. And then the next morning when the instructions were read to the jury, the judge had changed his mind on that, and afterwards, after the jury had started deliberating, the judge said he explained why he had done that. Now, this was
the first you learned of the change was when the instructions were being read to the jury?
He had handed two cases to Mr. Drummond and Mr. Schmitz's counsel and the defense counsel before reading the instructions and said, here are two cases. And so that morning they were given cases and they went right to argument. And then he read the instructions, which omitted the instruction he said he was going to give on the vegetation control regulation. And then he explained why he changed his mind after the jury.
I understand that, did he say when he gave the cases to counsel that he was going to change that particular instruction?
My recollection is that's not in the record, that was not reported. What we have in the record is that he said, after the jury started deliberating, he said, I want to explain, or I want to make a bit of a record on why this had been changed, and he relied on two cases. Now, Mr. Schmitz had been inspecting the locomotive at 2 a.m. in the morning with a lantern. There was no other light than the lantern. He testified that he fell into a hole that was obscured by some tall grass or vegetation. Mr. Drummond, as counsel for Mr. Schmitz, had tendered two instructions on the vegetation control regulation, which says that the railroad has an obligation to trim vegetation alongside the track so that it would not interfere with the duties, trackside duties of railroad employees. And the argument was that the railroad was negligent in failing to comply with this regulation. And the request was to instruct the jury in two respects. One, that there is an obligation under the federal regulation to trim the vegetation alongside the track so that it would not interfere with trackside duties. And second, that this Mr. Schmitz was contending that the violation of this regulation was a cause of his accident. When he stepped into a hole that he testified was obscured by tall vegetation that had not been controlled. Before trial, the railroad had no objection to the substance of that. They know about him. This is a very highly experienced defense counsel. He knows that under FELA, violation of any regulation, even if it's not intended to prevent this type of accident, can be used to establish negligence. So the only objection before trial by defense counsel was this: there's not going to be any evidence to support that. Well, the jury instruction conference rolled along. There was no longer an objection by defense counsel. Instruction.
Did the judge agree affirmatively to give that instruction or some modified version of it?
Oh, he said he was going to put that into his instruction. He said, let's just put that into my instructions that there was that this was a regulation and that this was an obligation on this regulation and this was your contention, this is one of your contentions of negligence. So it would be, he did agree expressly to incorporate that language in the court's instructions.
And did the proposed instruction also on this issue of the regulation also include language about this constituting negligence per se?
Yeah, but he asked for a special verdict on whether or not this was violated. And then Mr. Drummond's intent was if the jury had answered, yes, this was violated, then we would be able to say, well, that's negligence per se.
But this wasn't drawn to the court's attention here, Tom, that one of the theories being presented in the case and one of the instructions that would be sought was a negligence per se instruction based upon a violation of the safety regulation.
It was not phrased in terms of this is negligence per se. It was given, it attended as strictly as a negligence, that this is one of the theories of negligence. And that also was a special verdict, which would have meant that there was negligence per se. So
was the Cunningham case or the Walden case from the circuit cited in connection with the proposed instructions?
No, I think that Mr. Drummond was stunned that the rug being pulled out from under him.
Well, he couldn't have been stunned by that before he asked for the instructions. I'm asking what he specifically brought to the court's attention at the time of the instructions conference. I understand that he's saying he was sandbagged later on, but you know, when he proposed the instruction from the get-go, did he cite the Cunningham case or the Walden case? Did he phrase this in terms of a negligence per se argument and draw the court's attention to that nature of the claim?
He did not cite Cunningham. He did not cite Walden. He did not tender the instruction in terms of negligence per se. It was simply asked in terms of, and that again, I'm putting aside the special verdict, because I'm saying that the special verdict would have controlled, because that would have been negligence per se. But if we put it aside, the instruction he intended to ask the court to give would have said, this is the obligation, there's an obligation to trim under this federal regulation. Mr. Schmitz alleges negligence in the following respects, and an H or I was that they violated this obligation to control. They were negligent in failing to control vegetation alongside the trails in violation of this regulation.
Now, the impression the judge changed his mind, or else not to completely clear, because he felt that the regulation really wasn't directed to this kind of situation. Is that your impression? It's pretty difficult to tell whether it was or it wasn't directed to this kind of situation.
Well, he cited in two cases, Elston and Grimes. Elston and Grimes are the cases that where railroads argued that they complied with various regulations, and yet having complied with regulations, they were immune to being sued under the FDLA, which is not this case. And in the two cases they cited, Elston and Grimes, the court said, and that was going to a Seventh Circuit case, Waymire, I believe, Judge Bauer's decision, where the railroad said, we complied with the speed regulation. They said we can't go more than 60 miles an hour. Then the injured railroad employee said, yeah, we should have gone less than 60 miles an hour, even though the regulation said we could go up to 60. And the Court of Appeals, the Seventh Circuit, said the compliance with the regulation immunizes the railroad from FDLA liability for in that situation. Now, the Elston and Grimes, the two cases that were cited by the handed over by the district court judge in the present case, involved situations where the judges said, yes, the railroad argued that they complied with regulations and therefore should be immune. And the court said, yeah, but that doesn't immunize you from FDLA liability in this case. In those cases. But those cases didn't discuss Cunningham. They didn't purport to overrule the general rule that you can use, even if it's not negligence per se, that's the Isman case, even if it's not negligence per se, violation of a regulation can be used in an FDLA case to show that a railroad was negligent. And so the instructions were proper under pure negligence, even if you put aside negligence per se.
Were you given an opportunity to review and object to the instructions in the special verdict form at the time that they were apparently revised?
There's nothing in the record that shows that.
So all the record is going to show is that the judge did the revisions on his own, presented them to counsel, and there was no opportunity to review them before the jury was instructed and sent to deliberate?
I didn't see anything in the record showing that there's the new instructions were given to the counsel for review. I saw nothing like that in the record.
Was there an objection after the instructions were read to the jury? You know, hey, judge, that's not what we agreed to.
I believe that Mr. Drummond objected.
After
the jury was deliberating, so I don't know what I don't recall exactly, because at that point they were deliberating.
Well, we did have something in the record that preserved the argument that if he had done that, and it would at least potentially have been correctable at that point by the district court.
If I can answer quickly, I don't think he was obligated at that point. Under the rule, he was obligated that he was supposed to have been given the opportunity before deliberation. So I don't think that he had to keep jumping up and down and raising the issue.
But is it clear that counsel, before the jury went out to deliberate, had a copy of the final version of the special verdict form, which did not include the question about the violation of the regulation?
The record just is silent.
We just don't know it.
Yeah, it's just silent on that.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Frazier.
Your Honors, Bill Frazier, Sewell & Railroad Company. Counsel Cameron Yardman, on behalf of appellant plaintiff, was not the trial counsel at the time. Mr. Drummond was. I tried the case on behalf of the railroad. Jury instructions were submitted in the context of the progression of the case. They were submitted by both parties prior to the commencement of the trial. They were worked on again during the course of the trial. There was a instruction conference which led to the formation of the instructions by the court, which were to be given to the jury. After the last jury instruction conference, Judge Stopmuller took a break. I believe it was over a lunch break. He indicated at the time that he would review the instructions, finalize them, those which he said there were still some issues which he would resolve, and in fact he did. And he returned after the break. The instructions were resolved. Copies of the instructions were given to counsel.
When you say the instructions were resolved, by the court, they weren't acceded to by the counsel. In other words, counsel were not given an opportunity to review the instructions as the judge intended to give them to the jury and lodge an objection?
There was an opportunity to review the instructions proposed and objected to prior to the break, after which the judge...
There were changes made, apparently, during the break that had not previously been agreed to by counsel, right?
That's correct, but there were opportunities for counsel to direct comments and objections to the instructions which the court was considering at the time.
Well, yeah, but you got to say, counsel, these are the instructions I'm giving. Did it happen something like this, like you came back to present a final argument, you're given the instructions, counsel, you may proceed with your argument, kind of like that?
I believe the instructions, that there were minor modifications.
This is not a minor modification, Mr. Frazier.
Well, my recollection is that what was not included in the instruction was a specific cite to the code, the regulation, Section 213.37.
Well, that's pretty significant. If the jury had answered that question, and if that question had in fact been on the special verdict form, or if the jury had been instructed on that regulation and had found that it had been violated, that would constitute negligence per se. Or certainly be an independent basis for a finding of negligence by the jury. That's a very significant change.
Those instructions proposed and given had been discussed, proposed, objected to, and gone over prior to the finalization.
And the judge agreed to give it before lunch, but then after lunch, it wasn't in the instructions that were actually supplied to counsel and the jury and read to the jury.
I have no recollection that the judge agreed to give the specific cite to the regulation prior to the
Right, but counsel, wouldn't you agree that you've got to know what instructions are going to be given, and then you can make an objection? You can't just say, well, I may or may not give it.
There was an opportunity to do that, Your Honor.
After you finalized it?
The record would show that. I just remember discussing the instructions proposed and the instructions that the court indicated would be given. He said he wanted to consider it over that break. He came back and indicated what his consideration was, what instructions he was going to give, and I believe there was an opportunity to object to those instructions. There was no instruction ever requested, to my knowledge, on negligence per se.
Was he making a statement about this particular matter, this regulation, after he took it out of the instructions until the instructions had been given to the jury, is that right? He didn't come out and say, well, I changed these instructions in the final note for the final reason.
It wasn't a question of changing them. It was a question of finalizing the instructions that were proposed.
There was some consensus, perhaps, that it was in before this break.
I don't see it that way, Judge. And to answer your question, yes, he did advise as to what a judge...
Well, I mean, when he came back from the break, he didn't say, these are the changes I made from what the instructions were before lunch, and say why he made those changes. You're saying that...
He did.
He didn't do that till later, as I understand.
No, I believe he did it when he came back out and said, here's what we've done. And he cited to Grimes and to Elston... And
he did that before he gave the instructions.
And
that is my recollection.
And that should
be at that time, was the counsels, were they invited to comment, or did they make any statement, or what?
I don't know if we were invited to comment at the time. I know that he advised what changes, if you will, had been made, and I recall him specifically citing to Elston and Grimes and indicating that, incorrectly in my view, that they did not apply and do not apply.
Would that be a part of the record in this case?
That should be part of the record, Your Honor.
When we look at the record, we'll find, prior to the jury being instructed, we'll find the judge saying, I made these changes, and this is the kind of instruction I'm going to give, and then we move into final argument and instruction.
That is my recollection, Your Honor. The only thing I can't specifically recall is whether he gave us the opportunity to object then or indicated that we could make our record on objections after he had instructed the jury. And I just don't recall that, and I don't have a note in front of me on that. It should be reflected in the record.
I don't remember reading that in the briefs, but maybe it's there then.
Well, Your Honor, I think the real point here is what is the validity and correctness of the instructions as given. And I believe that there is no reversible error based upon the instructions to the jury. Because
you have to concede, counsel, that under the Crane case and the Walden case from the circuit, that the plaintiff was entitled to the instruction that he requested on the regulation. It doesn't matter that whether or not the regulation question was designed or intended to protect the plaintiff from the harm that is at issue in this case, that if the regulation was violated, that the jury instructions should have been, the jury instruction on the regulation and whether or not it was violated should have been given to the jury.
Well, number one, the regulation was never pled. Number two...
That's not necessary. You don't have to plead a specific violation of the regulation in a negligence case.
I believe the instructions as given were correct. And I believe that there was no evidence in this case which would allow a finding of a violation of the CFR.
That's an evidentiary decision.
Correct.
But the regulation that is at issue here, the plaintiff was entitled to have the jury instructed on that regulation as a basis for negligence in this case, under the Cronin case and the Lavin case. I don't see how you can reach any other conclusion.
I think either of those cases were cited by plaintiff at the time.
Yeah, that's a different issue. That's what we've been trying to get at all morning, about whether there was a sufficient objection lodged and whether there was an opportunity to object. But the law entitled the plaintiff to that instruction in this case. Or are you not conceding that?
I don't concede that, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because I don't think that it, I don't think that this regulation applied to the facts of this case. It doesn't apply to plaintiff's alleged.
Kern draws a bright line rule, and Walden from the circuit follows that bright line rule and says it doesn't matter if the plaintiff was within the zone of protection of the regulation in question. That if there's a regulation, a safety regulation that the railroad has to abide by, that it doesn't matter whether the plaintiff's particular harm the plaintiff suffered was included within the protection of that regulation, that the violation of that regulation is a basis for negligence, and in fact negligence per se.
And then there would have had to be evidence that the defendant in fact violated a regulation. And if that evidence was in the record and plaintiff had every opportunity to put it into the record, I would submit that the court did in fact instruct on that, with the exception of specifically citing 213.37.
So it's your position that there was no evidence that the regulation was violated? In other words, there's no evidence that the grass wasn't trimmed?
This was a country setting. The only evidence was that the plaintiff did not see what he now alleged to be a hole. There was evidence that there could have been burrowing under the area, and in fact there was evidence that what appeared to be the case is that when the plaintiff stepped in this particular area, the ground gave way. So there was, under those circumstances, no credible evidence which would allow a jury to determine.
There was evidence that the grass was a certain height, a foot and a half or something.
There was no evidence that the railroad was required to maintain it in any other condition. The railroad, under Grimes and Elston, have a duty to maintain roadbeds for the safety of the train travel, not as a walkway for its employees. That's the distinction of those cases, in my view, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Frazier.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
I'll give you 1 more minute. You're out of time.
If I may, very quickly, because in the beginning of the record, I had my eureka moment. On page 235 is the part of the record in the appendix, the Circuit Rule 30B appendix. Mr. Drummond specifically asked for that instruction on the vegetation control regulation. The court said, okay, and I think the court brought that to my attention as well. He said on page 235 he was going to give it. Then on page 245, Mr. Drummond asked for this special verdict on the violation of the vegetation control regulation, saying if that's the answer, yes, then the contributory negligence of the plaintiff is then erased or vacated or barred under Section 53 of the FVLA. In other words, he did ask for that in terms of it controlling on negligence per se. The court said, all right, Mr. Frazier. Mr. Frazier said, I believe it's an additional element of negligence as pled, Your Honor, and I think the verdict is, it reflects that status at this point. And then when you go to page 307, after the jury started deliberating, the court said on the matter of jury instructions, I wanted to make a bit of the record. And then he said, in the two cases that the court has furnished to counsel, that's the only reference that I saw that before deliberations they were given any opportunity. It's just, from what I can see, all you can infer is that the judge says, in these cases were furnished to counsel. So it just doesn't reflect that they had an opportunity to object.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.